Hello, and welcome to the March IASB Update podcast. I am Neely Shaw, the Executive Technical Director at the IASB, and today, as always, I am joined by the Chair of the IASB, Andreas Barco, and the Vice Chair, Linda Mazon-Hutter. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Neely. Let's get started.
Together, we will share with you the key highlights from our March IASB meeting. This month's IASB agenda was filled with a range of interesting topics, from primary financial statements to business combinations, disclosures, goodwill, and impairment. In fact, we have so much to share with you that this session will be a little bit longer than usual, so do bear with us. And let's dive straight into it. So we'll start with our new maintenance and consistent application project that has been added to our work plan. This project is called Climate-Related Risks in the Financial Statements. Andreas, would you like to talk us through the IASB's discussion about this project?
Sure, Nelly, with pleasure. Let me start by providing a little history and context of this project. IFRS accounting standards already require companies to consider climate-related matters in their financial statements when the effect of those matters is material. We've highlighted these requirements in educational materials and articles published on our website in 2019 and 2020. In our third gender consultation, our stakeholders told us that there may be inconsistent application of requirements and accounting standards and insufficient information disclosed about climate-related risks in the financial statements. To address our stakeholders' feedback, the IASB will explore the nature and causes of concerns in this project. By better understanding these causes, we can be more informed about appropriate actions to take. The outcomes of this project will be narrow in scope, such as minor amendments to IFRS standards, new illustrative examples, and or educational materials. At our March meeting, the IASB discussed the initial work it will undertake with regards to this project, which will include research and outreach to better understand the nature and causes of stakeholder concerns about the reporting of climate-related risks in the financial statements. The IASB will also consider the work of its sister board, the ISSB, to ensure any proposals work well with IFRS sustainability disclosure standards, in particular S2, that are due to be issued later this year.
Thanks, Andreas. I think what you just described is a great example of connectivity between the IASB and ISSB. And on that note, last week, as you know, you and Emmanuel Favre, the chair of the ISSB, published an article on our website explaining how we are approaching connectivity between the boards. You also published a second article on our website illustrating connectivity in the context of this project, Climate in the Financial Statements. So with that, let's move on to the second topic we discussed this month, the post-implementation review, or PIR for short, of IFRS 15, on revenue with contracts with customers. And just as a reminder, PIRs are not standard-setting projects, and they are not intended to lead to the resolution of every application question in a standard. Instead, PIRs are mechanisms to assess whether the effects of applying new requirements are as intended when the IASB developed those requirements. Linda, could you provide us with a bit of context about this project?
Yes, of course, Neely. I'd be pleased to do that. The IASB is working towards publishing a request for information, likely in June, to obtain feedback from stakeholders about how IFRS 15 works in practice. To inform the questions we ask in the RFI, we have been conducting outreach over the past several months. In March, the board discussed the feedback received, as well as the IASB's review of academic literature, and decided to seek further feedback in the RFI on the following areas of IFRS 15. First, we want to hear more views about IFRS 15 as a whole, including about the assessment of the clarity and suitability of the main model in the standard. The IASB will also consider feedback on the understandability of the technical aspects, terminology, and concepts in the standard, which will help with the scope of future standard-setting projects, as well as ongoing costs and benefits of applying IFRS 15. There will also be a question in the consultation about the importance of retaining convergence between IFRS 15 and the FASB's related topic. It was encouraging to us to hear from initial feedback that the standard appears to be generally working as intended. Second, we want to look at the situations where the requirements on the five-step revenue recognition model or other requirements in the standard are unclear, may be applied inconsistently or lead to significant costs. So we will be asking for evidence of challenges relating to identifying performance obligations, determining the transaction price, in particular with respect to consideration payable to customers, determining the timing of revenue recognition, especially applying the criteria for revenue recognition over time, principal versus agent considerations, and licensing. We will also seek further feedback on the disclosure and transition requirements in IFRS 15, including the costs of meeting those requirements and the benefits of the resulting information to investors. And lastly, the ISB will be asking about the application of IFRS 15 alongside other standards. Here, the ISB decided to focus on the interaction with these three standards: IFRS 3, business combinations; IFRS 9, financial instruments; and IFRS 16, leases. The ISB will consult in these matters publicly in the next phase of this PIR.
So something to look out for, the request for information that Linda just described coming out in June. So moving on, the ISB also discussed the Primary Financial Statements Project, or PFS for short. Just to provide a bit of background, the PFS project proposes to improve communication in the financial statements with a focus on the statement of profit or loss. Last year, the ISB made key decisions towards the end of the third quarter, and then in the fourth quarter, performed outreach to test and get feedback on some of the major changes from the proposals in the exposure draft. In January, the ISB discussed the feedback that it had received and revised its redeliberations plan. This month, the ISB started discussing the redeliberations and covered three topics. One is the disclosure of operating expenses by nature, two, management performance measures, and three, subtotals and categories in the statement of profit or loss, including issues related to companies with specified main business activities. Andreas, could you start us off on the first topic, the disclosure of operating expenses by nature?
I'll do my very best. You may recall that in July 2022, the ISB decided to require a company to disclose the amounts of depreciation, amortization, and employee benefits included in each function line item in the statement of profit or loss. This month, the ISB tentatively decided to slightly expand the scope of this requirement to also include impairments and write-offs of inventory and confirm that a company would disclose this information in a single note. And we did so because of proximity between impairments, write-downs, and amortization and depreciation. In addition, the ISB decided to provide application guidance clarifying that the amounts required to be disclosed are not required to be expense amounts, but a company would be required to provide a qualitative explanation if part of the amount disclosed has been included in the carrying amount of assets.
Thank you, Andreas. So with the PFS project, we also discussed management performance measures. And as a reminder for our audience, management performance measures are sort of what people call non-GAAP measures or alternative performance measures. They're subtotals of income and expenses that are used in public communications outside the financial statements to communicate management's view of an aspect of a company's financial performance. In the March meeting, the ISB completed its discussions on three aspects of management performance measures. The first is the rebuttable presumption used in the definition of management performance measures. The second is the relationship between these measures and the accounting policy requirements in IAS 8 and interim financial reports in IAS 34. And the third aspect of management performance measures discussed this month related to tax disclosures. Linda, can you start filling us in?
I'd love to get started on that. Let's first talk about the decisions the ISB made regarding the rebuttable presumption. You may recall that in November 2021, the ISB decided to establish a rebuttable presumption that a subtotal of income and expenses be included in public communications outside the financial statements. This would represent management's view of an aspect of the company's financial performance and provide application guidance for when a company may rebut this presumption only when it has reasonable and supportable information that the presumption is not true. At this meeting, the ISB did some fine-tuning to this application guidance and tentatively decided to add some examples to illustrate when a company would not be able to rebut this presumption. Let's now talk about the second aspect, the decisions the ISB made about disclosure of changes to management performance measures and the relationship between management performance measures and accounting policies. The exposure draft proposed that a company provides comprehensive disclosures when it introduces a new measure or changes or removes previously disclosed measures. These requirements mean a company would have to disclose the reasons for the change, addition, or removal of a measure and are intended to provide users with greater transparency. Companies would also be required to provide comparative information for these measures so that users can perform trend analysis. However, the ISB tentatively decided that a company would not be required to provide comparative information when it is impracticable to do so. The ISB also tentatively decided to clarify that the choice of a management performance measure, including how it is calculated, is not an accounting policy as defined by IAS 8. This is because a company sets its accounting policies within the constraints of IFRS accounting standards for its financial statements, not for communications outside the financial statements. This means that changes to MPMs do not need to meet the requirements in IAS 8 regarding changes in accounting policies, but they would need to meet the requirements we have developed specifically for changes to MPMs. And finally, we also made a decision on MPMs and interim financial reporting. The exposure draft proposed that a company would provide the disclosures for management performance measures in its interim financial reports. At this meeting, the ISB decided to expand this proposal and also require a company to provide the disclosures for changes to management performance measures that we just discussed in the interim financial statements.
Thanks, Linda. And so moving on to the third aspect of management performance measures that we discussed this month, the ISB continued discussing the requirement to disclose the tax effect for each item included in the reconciliation between a management performance measure and the most directly comparable subtotal or total specified by IFRS accounting standards. In March, the ISB decided to retain the option of calculating the tax effects of the reconciling item at the statutory tax rates applicable to the underlying transactions in the relevant jurisdictions, and to provide as well entities with two additional options. So with that, we finished the recap of the decisions made on management performance measures. Andreas, why don't we continue with the decisions the ISB made on the categories in the statement of profit or loss?
Yeah, happy to explore that with you. This month, the ISB discussed and made tentative decisions on some issues for categories in the statement of profit or loss. One of the issues discussed was the classification of foreign exchange differences on certain liabilities, such as lease liabilities, defined benefit liabilities, and decommissioning provisions that are denominated in a foreign currency. Only interest expenses on these liabilities are classified in the financing category. So stakeholders asked the ISB to clarify how a company would classify foreign exchange differences on these liabilities. The ISB had a robust discussion and decided that a company would apply judgment to determine which category in the statement of profit or loss it should classify them in. Another issue discussed was the classification of income and expenses from specific hybrid contracts, for example, payables for goods and services received with a prepayment option that are measured at amortized cost in their entirety. The ISB tentatively decided to require a company to classify all income and expenses arising after initial recognition from these specific hybrid contracts in the financing category to keep the requirements simple and easy to apply.
Thank you very much, Andreas. And to close off the updates on PFS, Andreas, could you tell our listeners about the decisions made on the issues related to the proposals for companies with specified main activities? So what we're talking about here are companies that invest or provide financing to customers as a main business activity. So banks, as an example.
Sure. And I can be very brief, Nili. The ISB discussed the classification of cash and cash equivalents for companies that provide financing to customers as a main business activity. The ISB decided that these companies would have an accounting policy choice to classify all income and expenses from cash and cash equivalents or the portion related to providing financing to customers in the operating category so that they can be included in net interest income, which is a key operating performance metric of these companies.
Thanks, Andreas. So let's move on to another standard setting project, and that is business combinations, disclosures, goodwill, and impairment. That's all one project despite the very long name. So this month, the ISB began its discussions on possible changes to the impairment tests used in the accounting for goodwill and continued its discussion on the disclosures related to business combinations. Linda, would you like to tell us about the decisions to change the impairment test?
Yes, Neely, of course. Love to. Within this project, the ISB is considering two types of changes to the impairment test in IAS 36 impairment of assets. These are changes that will improve the effectiveness of the impairment test, achievable at a reasonable cost, and changes that will reduce the cost and complexity of the impairment test without significantly reducing the effectiveness of the test. This point we discussed at this month's meeting. During the discussion, the ISB confirmed its preliminary view and proposed to remove a constraint in IAS 36 on cash flow projections used to estimate value in use. As a result, the company would no longer be prohibited from including in its estimation cash flows arising from future restructuring to which the company is not yet committed, or from improving or enhancing an asset's performance. One area of debate on this decision is whether this could exacerbate management over-optimism in the impairment test without additional constraints on the inclusion of some of these cash flows. Some stakeholders had told the ISB additional constraints were needed to discipline the inclusion of some of these cash flows in estimating value in use. The ISB noted that there are a number of constraints already in IAS 36 on cash flows. For example, ISB members noted the requirement to use reasonable and supportable assumptions in the impairment test, or to base the cash flows on forecasts on the most recent budgets approved by management. As a result of these existing constraints, the ISB decided not to add any more. The ISB also decided to make one other change in how value in use is estimated. The ISB decided to remove from IAS 36 the requirement to use pre-tax cash flows and pre-tax discount rates in estimating value in use. This was another of the ISB's preliminary views, and it attracted widespread stakeholder support. A company would still be required to disclose the discount rates used in its estimation and to use internally consistent assumptions for the cash flows and discount rates.
Thanks, Linda. Now, the other aspect of the project that we discussed was removing disclosure requirements in IFRS 3 business combinations. Andreas, could you elaborate on that?
Sure, Neely. Some stakeholders have told us that the disclosure requirements in IFRS 3 are excessive and costly to comply with. Some said that if we had new requirements to disclose information about the subsequent performance of acquired businesses, we should remove some other disclosure requirements. At this meeting, we reviewed stakeholder suggestions for disclosure requirements we could remove from IFRS 3. After considering these suggestions, we decided to remove a few detailed disclosure requirements from IFRS 3, primarily because they duplicate other disclosure requirements and therefore were redundant. In future meetings, the ISB will continue its discussion about the impairment test in IAS 36, our standard on impairment of assets, and clarify other aspects of the package of disclosure requirements for business combinations.
Thank you, Andreas. So now let's move on to the last standard setting project discussed this month, the Disclosure Initiative, Subsidiaries Without Public Accountability Disclosures Project. This project is for a new IFRS accounting standard that would permit eligible subsidiaries to apply IFRS accounting standards with reduced disclosure requirements. So what we're talking about here are situations where the group prepares financial statements applying full IFRS. Their subsidiaries, if they are SMEs, could apply the recognition and measurement requirements in full IFRS accounting standards, but with reduced disclosures. This new standard would save costs in the preparation of financial statements for both the subsidiaries eligible as well as the group without impairing the quality of information available to users of those subsidiary financial statements. Linda, could you tell us about the discussions this month on the project?
Neely, I'm happy to do that. This month, the discussion focused on clarifying the relationship between the new standard and the IFRS for SMEs accounting standard. There has been some confusion about the relationship because the exposure draft used the IFRS for SMEs accounting standard disclosure requirements as its starting point for developing the proposed disclosures. This led to questions about how the new standard interacts with the IFRS for SMEs accounting standard, specifically the approach to developing future disclosure requirements. The ISB noted that the new standard will be updated as new and amended IFRS standards are developed, while the IFRS for SMEs accounting standard will continue to be updated periodically. Therefore, there will be separate consultations for updating both standards. Finally, the ISB decided that in developing reduced disclosure requirements, the ISB will assess separately the costs and benefits for subsidiaries applying the new standard and SMEs applying the IFRS for SMEs accounting standard.
Thanks, Linda. So that concludes the board's discussions on standard setting projects. Now, before we wrap up the podcast, let's move to our research project on the equity method of accounting, where the board made some milestone decisions. As a reminder, the objective of this project is to assess whether application questions on the equity method, as set out in IAS 28 Investments in Associates and Joint Ventures, can be addressed by identifying and explaining principles in IAS 28. This month, the ISB concluded discussions on two significant application questions. Andreas, could you tell us more?
Yes, sure, Nelly. The first question we discussed is how an investor should apply the equity method when purchasing an additional interest in an associate while retaining significant influence. After much discussion over the past several months, this month, the ISB concluded its discussions and tentatively decided that when applying IAS 28, an investor purchases an additional interest in an associate while retaining significant influence, it will recognize any difference between the cost of the additional interest and its additional share in the net fair value of the associate's identifiable assets and liabilities, either as goodwill or a gain from a bargain purchase. The second question discussed was how an investor should recognize gains and losses that arise from the sale of a subsidiary to its associate, applying the requirements in IFRS 10, Consolidated Financial Statements, and IAS 28. We had a good debate again on the alternatives and the feedback at this month's meeting. In the end, the ISB tentatively decided to no longer require elimination of gains and losses on transactions with its equity accounted investments. In making this decision, the ISB noted that this may require some changes to disclosures, and so at a future date, the ISB will look at this. We recognize that this is a significant change to current practice and will involve transition costs, but we hope these to be outweighed by less complexity and less ongoing costs going forward. As always, we will consult on this matter, so do let us know your views.
Thank you, Andreas. That is indeed a milestone decision. As next steps, the ISB will continue its discussions on the application questions within the scope of this project and decide whether to publish an exposure draft or a discussion paper. So that concludes our very busy March discussions. But before we wrap up, let me update our listeners on some of our most recent publications. This month, the ISB published an exposure draft called Amendments to the Classification and Measurement of Financial Instruments, which will be open for comment until the 19th of July. We invite you to have a look at the exposure draft and provide us with your feedback. In addition, the IFRS Interpretations Committee published three new tentative agenda decisions, which are open for comment until May 2023. The documents are available on our website, and you can also listen to the IFRIC podcast to get more information about these new tentative agenda decisions. And finally, we published the IFRS Accounting Taxonomy 2023, which is based on IFRS accounting standards as at 1 January 2023, including those issued but not yet effective. Users can now access the taxonomy in the Standards Navigator on our website.
Nearly unrelated to our technical discussions, can I also mention that this month we welcomed our 13th ISB board member, Hagit Sharon. Hagit has nearly 20 years' experience in auditing financial statements prepared using IFRS accounting standards and helping companies to implement and apply our accounting standards. We are truly thrilled to have her on our board.
Thank you, Andreas. The 13 down and one more to go, right?
That's right. That's next month, right?
Can't wait. So that is all for this month's podcast. You can catch up on previous episodes of this and the IFRS Interpretations Committee podcast on our website, as well as on YouTube or Spotify. For the latest developments, make sure to subscribe to our website. And if you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Thank you very much for joining us, and please tune in next time for an update on the April IASB meeting. Thank you.